You are listening to CFRO 102.7 on your FM dial, the only local station that is truly independent. Co-op Radio has no corporate or institutional sponsors. Programmers are free to speak openly on all important issues without concern of losing sponsorship financing. But of course, we have to have money to keep the station operating and to keep programs such as Animal Voices, which is coming up on the air, every program has an annual quota to reach, and we would like to ask our listeners' help in making that quota this fall. So will you please, during the coming hour, call us at 604-684-8494 and make a pledge. Thank you. You are listening to Animal Voices, and our program is going to have an interesting guest and several other items, which I'll tell you about now. It's a weekly program presented through the cooperation of three local charities, Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection, Earth Save Canada, and the Vancouver Humane Society. These societies do not necessarily support all the ideas expressed on this show. My name is Marge Adams. And in the studio with me are co-hosts John Pranger and Carl Loskin. John Pranger today is serving as our technician. Also in the studio is Conrad Schmidt of the Work Less Party. Conrad has recently published a book, and he will be telling us about that along with a lot of other wonderful ideas that he has. Carl will be interviewing Conrad very shortly. And I understand Conrad is going to be interviewing Carl also. We'll see how that works out. Later in the hour, Carl, who is an amateur mycologist, will be informing us about the humble mushroom. And I want to tell you a little bit about animal care during the Halloween season, which is coming up very soon. What is it, next Thursday, I believe. Now I'm going to turn the show over to Carl and his interview with Conrad.
Thank you, Marge. Conrad Schmidt is the founder of the Work Less Political Party. Yes, it is a viable political party, and he is also the author of the book Workers of the World Relax. Well, welcome to Animal Voices, Conrad Schmidt.
Well, thank you very much. It's a great honor to be here on the show with you today.
It's a great book, and on your webpage, which we'll mention afterwards, people can have a look at it. But first about you, and why you wrote this book, and what are the core problems facing society at this time?
Well, why did I write the book? I think there's a lot of important issues that are connected to our work ethics. A lot of the trouble and a lot of the environmental and social issues are so connected. I wanted to write something that connected environmental issues and social issues. And that's why I wrote the book, Workers of the World Relax.
Right. Now, we have the bigger picture, of course, the core problems that are facing society here and...
Yes, there is something I'd like to talk about. There is something that's more serious than climate change. It's the biggest threat that humanity has ever faced. And it's an economics principle. It's known as the Jevons paradox. And it's not something that's often talked about, but it is the biggest threat facing humanity. It's a core problem. It's part of how we live our lives. And let me explain why this is such a serious issue. Let me give you an example. There are many examples of this. In 1970, the price of oil rose. And so the United States was getting a little worried, and they decided in Congress, well, we need to reduce the amount of money we spend on oil, because the price had risen to $80 a barrel. And they decided to legislate an efficiency increase in automobiles. They wanted to make cars 20% more efficient. They thought that you made cars more efficient, you would save money on oil. The exact opposite happened. It was a paradox. By 1990, cars were 34% more efficient, but expenditure on oil had increased by 7%. And why? Well, you see, what happens? We drove more cars. We traveled more. We traveled further. We bought new, more efficient cars. And each one of those things has an environmental and an oil footprint. Let me explain it this way. Suppose that I drive a big SUV and I feel bad. Oh, the world's going to hell. What am I going to do? I have to get a more efficient car, a hybrid. And so I then get something that's more efficient. Or even worse, I get a bicycle. Now, what happens is that the person who just changed has now got potentially an extra $500, $600, maybe $700 extra cash per month. What are they going to do with that money? If they take that money and then go on a trip to Mexico or Cuba, then you're increasing your footprint. One transatlantic flight has about a 1.5 tons worth of CO2 emissions. Or if I take that money and build a bigger house or an apartment, again, each one of those things has a very, very serious environmental footprint. If I decide I'm going to buy a computer and cameras and electronic goods, those things, again, have a very, very serious environmental footprint. Each step of the way, we're increasing our footprint when we think that we're decreasing it. The point is, the greener a technology, the more efficient it is, the more of a threat it is to the planet. This is a serious thinking because the world leaders today. I was listening to George Bush talking about how technology is going to come to our rescue. No, it can't. It won't. If you look through history, coal was cleaner and more efficient than wood. Petrol was cleaner and more efficient than coal. Each one of these things was a greener technology. And each one of these things resulted in us getting into the mess that we are in today.
So even if we become more productive, it can have the opposite effect, as you said,
Jevons paradox.
So even when we become more productive, it's not helping us.
It's the efficiency that's going to kill the planet. Now, there is a solution. Well, you see, you can. Now, if, say, I change to a bicycle and then I change my lifestyle, or I take that extra money and I just tear it up, then again, I've reduced my footprint because now I'm not spending that extra money in computers and houses or vacations or more kids or whatever I spend it on. Then you're reducing it. The only other way you can reduce your footprint is by reducing the industrial work week. It's the only possible way. You see, can I give you my example? Like, that's how I came to the idea and the revelation about the Work Less Party and Workers of the World Relax, is that I used to be a computer programmer. And I used to go to the office and I used to type away, ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. And the software that I was making was running factory plants in the States that were making cars, cigarettes, huge amounts of consumer goods. Mm-hmm. And I had to ask myself, who was I? And the answer that came back to me was I was an environmental hazard. I wasn't a productive member of society. So the first thing I did to reduce my footprint was I sold my car. But when I sold my car, I had an extra $400-$500. And I said, what am I going to do with this money? Should I spend it on a trip? Should I get a bigger home? What should I do with it? Then I realized that if I spent that money, I'd be increasing my footprint again. So what I did was I reduced my work week from a 5-day to a 4-day work week. My car was costing me 20% of my income, so I reduced my work week by 20%.
And that's how you came to the figure of that a work week should be all of 32 hours.
32 hours is a start. Let's go to 32. Netherlands is pretty much at a 32-hour work week. Lots of European countries have a reduced work week. And Europe consumes approximately 50% less energy and consumer goods than the average North American. Like Netherlands has a 32-hour work week. France, they're still at 35. Germany is about 37. And most of those countries, you start off with a 4-week vacation, six-week vacation, and you move up from there. And the only thing that's ever been proven to reduce our environmental footprint. It's not green technology, I tell you that. That is the worst you can do. It's how we live our lives and reducing our work week so we got more time for things that are good for people and good for the planet, like music, art, family, culture, spending time with your kids, raising a healthy society, caring, compassion. These things make people happy, improve our standard of living, and reduce our environmental footprint. It's so simple. Climate change, this is something I always say, climate change is not difficult to solve, but but it is impossible to solve it and make money solving it. Mm-hmm. There are solutions, but they're not profitable, but they're good for people. We have to stop thinking about everything having to make a profit. New products are going to come save us, make us rich, and save the planet. It's not going to happen.
That's what Dion is advocating. We can make money on this newest crisis.
Yeah, everybody is trying to bank on this newest crisis. Mm-hmm. But it can't. Like George Bush is saying the same thing. Green technology is coming to our rescue. I was listening to George Bush saying this. Harper is saying this. Everybody's saying it. All the leaders across the world. But it's green technology that got us into this mess. And the only thing that can save us is ourselves, how we live our lives, social wealth in the sense of how we develop community, how we care for each other, music, art, family, community, culture. Those are the things that make and improve our standard of living and reduce our environmental footprint, and those are the only things.
So we return to, we save our environmental footprint by going to real values here. And mm-hmm. You ran in the polls on your political party on this. And do people really go for this idea of having more fun and enjoying themselves? Is this catching on?
Yes, absolutely. But we have to look back. This is not a new concept. The entire platform is nothing new. If you look at Europe itself, from 1970, Europe started reducing their work week. They were actually working more than North Americans up to that point. Then they started realizing that there's more to life, and they started increasing vacation times, reducing the work week. And they have been able to, if you look at that, they have lower crime rates, higher standards of education, they got better Medicare systems, and they got people more with more time for music, art, culture, and enjoying life. It's not a new concept.
Yeah, we have to change, though, so much, don't we? Because we are such an advertising society, constantly pushing material goods. And we've got to get rid of that and educate people from a young age to enjoy the real beauties of life and the planet and mm-hmm. the pleasantness of not being ridden by high blood pressure and heart attacks and all this stuff, because you would live a gentler life.
That's the idea. That's a lesson, and it's up to people, us, to make that transformation. Corporations and the government are not needed. We can make those changes. And that's why I've been focusing on creating so many community events, art shows, music performances. We make documentary films. We write books. Just bring community together and do stuff. We even got a theater group that's got a play in December. It's that type of stuff where you bring people together, enjoy life, create community, and reduce your footprint. Yeah. Happy people are good for the planet. Miserable people that are hard at work in their cars and stuck in traffic jams are bad for the planet. It's so simple. Happy, good. Miserable, not.
High production and high consumption, these are two things that go together. I mean, you explained mm-hmm. it so well. And it's how we compare to our European counterparts. But we do deal with governments here, and after all, you are a political party. So you said, let's, if the people are ready, the governments will act. Mm-hmm. But how do you see in any way that the governments can act on anything that is like what you're saying here? And to my mind, it's based on true facts and true living and environmental soundness. Let's say it straight from Conrad Schmick and the book called Workers of the World Relax. Maybe you can answer that as we approach a world so dominated by politics and the government.
Mm-hmm.
What is the next step there?
Well, firstly, the reason why we created a political party was not that we really want to win elections. It was that when you create a political party, you get a mouthpiece, a voice to talk about these things.
Okay.
We call it the Workers of the World. We call it the Workless Party, because we wanted to get the idea out there, to get airtime and talk about it. But our true focus is building community, organizing events, bringing artists, musicians, poets together, activists together, support local grassroots movements like the Workless Party. We do 14 fundraisers every year. Actually, it's more than that, but minimum 14. 12 of those fundraisers are for other groups. Only 2 are for the Workless Party. We're doing one tomorrow. Oh, no, sorry, it's today. Oh, geez, I'm in trouble. It's going to be at the Answer Club. And we got a great lineup of musicians and performers. And this fundraiser is for Co-op Bookstore. We want to support the local small independent bookstores because they are essential. And we're going to do one for Spartacus. We did one last month for Betty Kraswick. And again, that's what it is. What we do is we support community. That's our primary focus. And every month, fundraiser for some group. And it's important. We have to keep these local groups functioning, small bookstores. And the lineup is, if I can promote, just take a second. It's a good lineup. We got Carnival Band, we got Down Low, which is dub rock, and we got 2 great DJs and some performances, and that's at the Anza. $5 if you arrive in costume, $10 otherwise. And proceeds go to Co-op Bookstore.
And when is that?
Tonight.
Tonight?
Doors open at 8 o'clock.
Okay. Now, there was a great performance, Conrad, and it was always so nice to see you organize an event so successfully. And that was when it was a very emotional moment for me, too, when Betty Kraswick stood outside the law courts. And here is another principle which I think is mentionable, is that she received a 10-month sentence for opposing the system.
Exactly.
And many people, maybe you'd like to explain that a bit. One's opposing the system. In many ways, do you think you're opposing the system here? I mean, are you a threat to the system? But let's talk about Betty Kraswick first.
Betty, and also not just Betty, let's talk a little bit about Harriet Nahani as well. Mm-hmm. Her sentence was even more severe than Betty's. These 2 elderly women who I have a lot of respect for were both at Eagle Ridge. They didn't yell at anybody. They didn't swear at anybody. They didn't break anything. And the rest of the Eagle Ridge Coalition, they got fines. But these 2 elderly women who were leaders of the communities, who were the most prominent outspoken people, got the more severe sentences, like Harriet. She was sentenced to 2 weeks in prison. Nobody else got a prison term. She didn't do anything wrong. And she unfortunately contracted pneumonia while she was in prison and was complicated by undiagnosed lung cancer. But she shortly after being released died. She didn't break anything. She was there. She stood at Eagle Ridge and says, "I'm protecting this land for future generations." Same as Betty. They both stood there. They would sit there and they'd drink their tea together. And that's what they'd say. "We're here to protect this land for future generations." And it's because they were the strongest that they got the more severe sentences. There were other people that were more aggressive, that were more radical. Nothing compared to those 2. And Betty's going to run for mayor, Workless Party.
So the question, yes, she's going to run for mayor. The question here was about opposing the system and many other people who commit violent crimes, killing people. What about that?
Well, for me, the way I don't look at it is that I'm not opposing the system. What I'm trying to do is rebuild community.
Okay.
Reconnect people, promote the artists, support people in their ideas, beliefs, in creating that community nature that is essential to solving the problems that we're facing, environmental and social problems. I don't break the law, but I want to connect people and support different groups and create that network. It's not that I'm opposing the system. It's that the system opposes anybody that tries and does something like that.
To obtain really sustainable solutions, are there any lessons that we can learn from history and the laws of nature?
Absolutely. Good question. As I said, the basic idea of a reduced work week is nothing new. It's happened before. I mean, if you look back in history, during the Great Depression, one of the solutions that they had was to reduce the work week. There was even a time that a 6-hour day was almost legislated. And we can look at Europe that has followed a policy of reducing their work week. And there's so many communities that have reduced the work week and been able to improve their standard of living. That's the Haymarket riot. Remember the slogan? Oh, you wouldn't remember the slogan. That was well over 100 years ago. The slogan was "Give us bread, but give us roses too." Bread. This was the original union slogan. Bread symbolized money, but the roses symbolized the quality of life, which was also about a reduced work week. The union movement forgot about the roses. It used to be part of their platform. It was bread and roses. And what I'm trying to do, and the people that I'm working with in this collective, is to remember the roses, because it's the roses that will save us.
Now, to get your message across, of course, one often has to use some somewhat fairly controversial methods. I know People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals does it to use slogans, but also you've had to use that. And how do you justify some of your bicycle rides?
I don't think I've actually ever. Yes, I've done stuff that is questionable. It depends how you read the law. The law, for the most part, the law is a tool that's wielded to keep this type of stuff, community groups, and not happening. Mm-hmm. But we haven't done anything really wrong. Yes, no. The law, of course, there might be a few things that we're breaking, minor things, but it's really the law that's being used to stop this.
Right. Anyway, we are talking with Conrad Schmidt. Mind if you got any questions? He wrote a book called Workers of the World Relax. Maybe you can give us a little intro here. You've given us lots of food for thought here to my mind, creating a better world.
Now, I do have a question about unions. Now, I usually think of unions as fairly progressive force. I wonder if the Workless Party has ever tried to influence union thinking in that direction, you know, by directly cooperating with the unions, perhaps.
It's the other way around. Uh-huh. The original union movement was what influenced and created the Workless Party philosophy. Uh-huh. They originally had the idea of a reduced work week and community, it was bread and roses. Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you talk about the roses being forgotten. I wonder if there would be a direct approach to the unions today that would change their thinking on that.
I hope so, but I don't know the answer. We haven't had much union support, and it is, again, just reminding them of their platform and the ideas that they originally had. Mm-hmm. That's where it came from.
What's the web page for your book? And then we'll go over to Marge and we'll do a bit of fundraising. Just give us a little shot.
Yeah, it's worklessparty.org. The book is available at Co-op Bookstore, Spartacus Bookstore, Banyan's, Duthie's, all the small bookstores. And yeah, anybody that's interested in getting involved, I'm making a movie at the moment. It's about Jevons Paradox and how it can be solved by re-enabling and empowering community. Anybody that's interested in getting involved in the project, whether they want to invest in the film or whether they want to film or whether they want to anything, that's what it's about. It's about community, bringing people together and making things happen. Give me a call. My telephone number is 604-537-2044. Again, 537-2044, and I'm easy to reach.
Thank you, Conrad, for coming in. And John?
Yeah, I wondered if there is any difference the word efficiency, can that be defined in various ways so that the way we've been defining it is maybe has very harmful results, but there is an efficiency which calculates all the troubles that could happen from becoming more efficient. And if we include that, there should be a way to, you know, get human innovation and forward thinking onto the into the marketplace and to producing things that can contribute to real leisure and real art and real ascendancy.
You see, we've got all of those things. We already have those things. If you take this, if you take the production of somebody that was working in the 1950s to today, now the average worker today, in the same time that somebody in the 1950s would spend 40 hours working to produce things, we can produce those things in just 11 hours. What's missing is that we have to take gains in efficiency and start investing it in social well-being and not in increased production and consumption. That's the balance, is that we have to start to learn how to enjoy life and take those benefits, that investment.
Yeah, like we're very efficient at raising chickens, but is it real efficiency?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, of course, the environmental footprint is also lower when we eat lower on the food chain. Is that correct?
Absolutely. A good example is this beautiful garden that I often go and visit. It's your garden. It's one of the most beautiful things that I ever see out there. Is Carl, that I have to applaud you for that garden of yours. For people that don't know, Carl has this in his property. He's turned his garden into a food garden, and it grows incredible. Whenever I go over there, there's always an incredible meal that he's prepared, something in his garden. And I think that's part of the solution, is people taking the time to grow their own food, people enjoying the life of creating the stuff that you need. And again, when you eat lower down in the food chain, when you look at how much oil, how much environmental damage goes into a meat-eating diet versus a vegetarian and then a vegan diet, it's essential.
Well, you know, when you plant a plum tree, and I always think that apple trees don't grow all that well here because it's a little bit moist here, but plum trees really do well. You know, 2 years ago I planted a little plum tree, and this year, last year didn't have any plums, but this year it had about 100 of these nice little red juicy plums. And you know, if you have a sunny spot, we have a nice sunny spot. I mean, what a blessing. And you know, you just have to, when you bite into it, it just, the juices just run down. And I mean, it's just unbelievable. And it's going to be producing for maybe 20, 30 years. So what an absolute legacy.
So how much food can you produce in that garden of yours?
As more than you can eat.
I notice there's always people coming over, and there never seems to be an endless supply of delicious
food.
Well,
the thing is that if you have healthy plants, you know, you don't have to use pesticides. We don't use any manure in the garden. We don't use any pesticides. Mm-hmm. And healthy plants don't get sick. It's something the same with a human body as well. When it gets all the nutrients it needs, like the minerals and vitamins and thing, and it's from organic sources, you don't get disease. We don't get aphids. We don't get all these common things. They are healthy. Plants are vibrant and healthy enough. Merely on all the leaves I collect from that's falling down now, we mulch them up, spread them on the ground like 4 or 5 inches thick, and dig them in lightly. And by spring next year, it's the earthworms are doing all the work.
What indigenous plants and crops do you grow?
Indigenous? Well, Conrad, I brought you a buttercup squash.
Butternut? Buttercup, is it?
Buttercup, yes. Not a butternut.
Wow, this
it's
is beautiful.
Inside,
wow.
Yeah.
Look at this.
There you go.
Super.
And you know, did the first thing with the buttercup this year. We have a garden shed, and the plant grew up onto the roof, and I put a sort of wood trestle over it, and it got all the heat from the roof. And just grew like crazy. Also, the butternut and walnuts are not from me.
Wow.
We don't have them. And there's an onion there. That's it's a Walla Walla onion. And you can see I put. If you bite into it,
it smells great.
It's sweeter than an apple. If you bite into
no
it,
no way,
absolutely
impossible.
Wow.
Let me give that a try.
It doesn't taste like an apple, though.
There we are. Can you hear Conrad crunching away? So,
this is really good.
It's sweet. It's a Walla Walla onion.
It's sweet, but it's not as sweet as an apple.
So what we have right now is lots of That's a little.
What is this?
This is a melon cucumber.
Oh. No way! I've never seen this before
and
in my life.
They're about the size of a tennis ball and looks about the same
heritage,
size.
Heritage fruit.
And one plant would produce about 30 or 40 of those tennis ball sized plants. Fruit. I mean, a cucumber is really a fruit. So the neat full sun.
And how many seeds are in that squash?
And you can eat the squash. And also, since Halloween time is coming, and people have pumpkins. Pumpkins is nutritious and healthy and should not be thrown out after Halloween night.
Imagine, all those hundreds of seeds become plants. We produce tens of those with more seeds. And how can there be scarcity in the world?
Absolutely.
The scarcity comes in the type of crops we're growing. 70% of all of the grain harvest in the States goes to feeding animals.
Wow.
And only you lose 90% of that value.
And yet people insist that that is the best and most efficient way to get protein, and everybody on the planet ought to eat that way.
It's just not possible.
We have this protein myth thing where we think we need to eat animal products to consume, to get our quantity of protein, whereas beans are some 34% protein, rice is 11% protein. There's protein in everything. We need protein, of course, but what we don't need is overconsumption of protein, and we don't need all the chemicals with which animal products are being pumped into steroids. Chickens on steroids to make them from egg to a fully grown broiler in 6 weeks.
And we don't need to take 70% of the entire agricultural produce and feed it to animals so that we can eat those animals.
That's a scandal.
I just want to ask you another question. What have I got in the garden right now? I got lots of kale, collards, and of course I harvested all my carrots, because if I leave them in the ground too long, you get carrot fly. There's lots of beets, and if I cover them with leaves, I had them right through till March. Leeks is one of my favorites.
I think I'm going to be visiting you this weekend.
There you go.
Where I work, which is a natural food store, you should see the lush vegetables and fruits that come in. But you compare that to the produce that's conventionally produced, and you will see that there's a liveness, a vibration, and an aura around these vegetables that it's absolutely lacking in conventionally produced, which is dead food.
And yeah, if you believe in sustainability, don't import your food from Jamaica. Grow it locally.
I guess we should move on now. It's the most interesting discussion that we've had with Conrad here. And if you'd like to hear more such discussions, you know what you can do. Support Co-op Radio. We are always in need of money, but this is our autumn airlift time and the last day of it. We haven't yet reached our quota, so we're asking you to call us at 604-684-8494 and make a pledge. We know we have great listeners, and they have not failed us in the past, so I expect that they will come through once again. And thank you for your past cooperation.
And you, I guess like Conrad here, do you think that other stations give you the opportunity that we can give you?
Co-op is unique. There is no other stations. CITR and Simon Fraser do a good job, but Co-op is something really special, and everything we have in Vancouver in the activist community and arts community, I think, has a lot to thank Co-op Radio for. Most of us and the stuff that I do, it would not happen without what Co-op Radio offers. Thank you so much.
And that one reason for that, of course, is we are an independent radio station. We're not depending on financing from any institution or corporation, so that programmers can design the programs and have guests like Conrad and feel comfortable getting the truth out, so that it's well worth your dollars to support Co-op Radio. So let me simply remind you, you are listening to CFRO 102.7 on the FM dial, commonly known as Co-op Radio.
No, that's not the way to go. You got to go slow.
Wanna find a rhythm that is oh so nice? If you wanna find a rhythm, you should take my advice. If you wanna find a rhythm, I can show you the way. Be like a duck. That's what I say. Be like a duck.
Be like a duck, be like a duck. Okay. A duck is so friendly,
duck is so friendly.
A duck is so proud.
A duck is, so
a duck is never ever just a face in the crowd. A duck is so clever, a duck
like
is
a
so
duck.
Free. Don't you wanna be just exactly like me? Be like a duck, be like a duck, be like a duck. You gotta walk the walk, you gotta talk the talk, and when you wanna fly, you gotta take to the sky and cruise. Be like a duck.
Yes, indeed.
Be like a duck.
Baby, you're strong.
No need for speed. Be like a duck. Like a duck.
Cool.
Maybe you stroll, maybe you fly, or maybe just float. Let the river run by. When the rain starts falling, let it roll off your back. Open up your beak and go quack, quack, quack. Be like a duck. You don't have to fret. Be like a duck. You can just get wet. Be like a duck. Be like a duck. Be like a duck. Get down. You gotta walk the walk. You gotta talk the talk. And when you wanna fly, you gotta take to the sky and cruise.
Maybe
you stroll, maybe you fly, or maybe just float and let the river run by. When the rain starts falling, let it roll off your back. Open up your beak and go quack, quack, quack. Be like a duck. You don't have to fuss. Be like a duck. You could be like us. Be like a duck. Be like a duck. Be like a duck. You gotta walk the walk. You gotta talk the talk. And when you wanna fly, you gotta take to the sky and cruise.
John, lovely music. And this is Marge Adams. I want to tell you a little bit about Halloween and pets, because I do have concern in this area. Now, Halloween is coming up next Thursday, and it can be a very frightening time for pets. Not only can pranksters be dangerous and frightening to companion animals, but they can also be terrifying. With the noise that they make with their firecrackers and other explosive devices. And this can injure innocent creatures and at times cause them to run away from home, which can be a major problem. And dogs especially are spooked by loud explosions. I'll tell you about time I was in California, and I'd lived there for several years and worked with the Yolo County SPCA, and every year we would get calls on July the 5th about missing dogs. And after the, of course, fireworks displays were always held on July the 4th and the night after darkness, and the pets would be absolutely terrified. And some of these pets never did get back home. They would run and run and run, so that... What I would like to suggest that if you have nervous pets, or any dog can get upset with the noise, put them inside your house preferably a place where the explosions cannot be heard. I know that I used to put my animals in a bathroom, and that was the quietest spot for them, and it worked, because I know how hard it is on a companion person to lose his dog, and it's something that can be avoided through careful preparation. So now we're going to go back to Carl, and he
I'd just like to follow up on the ghoulish moments that people might be having in the next week or so, but take care of your pets. But that doesn't mean to say you don't have to enjoy Halloween, because many people, as I was told, like to feel they are another persona at some time of the year. Some people like to be Father Christmas, the Easter Bunny or so, but here so is another opportunity to be another person. And so it's an interesting personality quest which people might like to go through. So nowadays, of course, the whole has become so commercial that most of these products that associated with Halloween come from China, cheap plastic goodies, and many people make their own. This morning I heard on the radio station that the average family spends $60 a year on Halloween. And here are some spooky statistics which says that 34% of the people in North America dress up in a costume, and 73% are handing out candy. And so maybe you can tell us about handing out candy. Are there any alternatives, Marge?
Oh, gosh, yes, there are. The thing, though, today, I know I used to make little goodies for the children, but I don't do it today because I don't have the packaging devices needed, because people are so frightened of getting anything that has been handled, so that it's difficult to make the kind of things like taffied apples and those kind of things people would make. But you certainly can buy nuts and dried fruits and so on that are good.
Yes, even the chocolate coated raisins and peanuts. Good alternatives, and I think they're available in good stores.
And there are now organic candies that you can buy too, or at least natural candies of various kinds, so they can easily substitute for the usual Halloween junk.
So, John, I wouldn't like to be personal, but how will you be dressing up for Halloween this coming week?
As my usual frightful self.
Well, you know, I have to tell you, you're not that frightful, but if maybe you wore your hat the other way around, that would scare maybe even the crows. So much for Halloween, okay.
But it used to be a lot less. I don't remember firecrackers at Halloween when I was young. Growing up in Ontario, there was no such thing. It was all people dressed strange costumes and collecting either money for UNICEF or candies. That was it. No firecrackers. So is that something that's of late, or is it something that's BC?
Well, I think it goes together with a world at war, this explosion kind of stuff. I believe it's very aggressive. Yeah. You leave it leaves chemicals in the air, and
it frightens everybody that hears it.
Frightens
not just
the
dogs and cats.
The birds, I mean, put your cats and dogs inside, but what about all the animals outside?
Right.
I mean, to my mind, it's a horror show. But I believe there are some web pages that you can do a kaboom on the monitor. So maybe you should Google monitor kaboom, and it'll satisfy the pyrotechnical urge in whoever wants to light firecrackers.
Yeah, and your own silly character.
Now, are you going to tell us about the mushrooms now, Carl?
I'm a mushroom. Yes, you know, it's also mushroom time right now, and it goes well together with Halloween, of course. But why are mushrooms so mysterious? In fact, they are one of the most mysterious life forms on planet Earth. When you consider that they grow in the dark, unlike plants, they don't have any photosynthesis. And a study at Indiana University said that fungi, that's mushrooms, in other words, it's a fungus. And they, in fact, are closer. It's a living organism, like all plants are. But the fungi are closer relatives to animals than plants. This study said that it was a genetic study, suggests that animals and fungi are sister groups, while plants constitute an independent evolutionary lineage. so we check. So I've been a member of the Vancouver Mycological Society for many years and studied mushrooms and enjoy eating them too. And at this time of the year, many mushrooms only come up in the spring. Some mushrooms only in the fall. And we've had a very favorable time for mushrooms right now because we've had warm weather and we've had adequate rain, a very adequate quantity of rain. Not so, John.
How long is the actual season for mushrooms?
Well, the season when the frost comes. Then it's over
They're absolutely essential in the ecology of
it's part of the decomposing process, mm-hmm. and that's why the different mushrooms you find in different areas, you'll find different fungi under different and older trees. You'll only find certain types of mushrooms under an older tree. Only find the pine mushroom under a pine tree, you know, the matsutake. But,
they are all identifiable, aren't they? And they have different characteristics, these mushrooms.
They are all identifiable, yes. And, you know, Paul Kruger, who is one of the leading persons at the Vancouver Mycological Society, they actually went on a foray in the sea shot. And they discovered new varieties. There are still so many undiscovered fungi and that haven't been documented. And that's also one of the tragedies of old growth rainforest destruction, is that we still do not understand all these mushrooms. Which leads me to the next story, which is that there actually was a single mushroom found in Michigan, and this single mushroom was 37 acres large. And the way they know that this was a single mushroom, because it came from one original spore and then spread in the undergrowth. It wasn't like a gigantic mushroom that was with a pedestal and then the cap on top.
Do most of these have an undergrowth under the soil as well as that top that we all are familiar with?
That's in fact so, mm-hmm. because we know from the pine mushroom, the very much venerated matsutake, which is they so much enjoy in Japan, is the matsutake. They've never been able to grow it in a culture like oyster mushrooms and many of the shiitake. They grow them in hot houses, mm-hmm. in containment. Mm-hmm. But the mycelium takes 9 years to germinate to produce a single pine mushroom. So when people were looking for these mushrooms, and you know, at one stage when people went out mushrooming out by Pemberton and up in the Nass Valley and everywhere, and they were destroying the beds by taking a rake looking for the pine mushroom. Oh. They destroyed this 9 year bed of fungi, mycelium, mm-hmm. that produced the pine mushrooms. Also, I know from where I pick the pine mushrooms that I know all the trees. Mm-hmm. It's out by Duffy Lake. It's not my secret spot. It's open for everybody. Mm-hmm. The same mushroom will come up every year at the same, like when the conditions are correct, yeah. Like I said, mm-hmm. Warmth with moisture. Mm-hmm. Then the mushrooms will come up. But the other thing is that when we have, in the beginning of the season, when you have light rain and you're eager to go out there looking for mushrooms, till the rain actually penetrates, mm-hmm. the undergrowth under the forest, then only the mushroom will grow. So often that is, you really need a heavy, heavy rainfall to start the germination. So I can actually look at a forest and I'll say, this type of mushroom will actually be likely to be there. I know with the pine mushroom that if there's old man, if it's facing south, the mountain, if there's old man's beard on the trees, it's pine mushrooms, and they are fairly interspaced between each other, not closely towards each other. There's a very good likelihood that these beloved pine mushrooms should be there. Now, I remember being in Japan, and when I was there, I went to a florist shop, and then I saw there that in Japan, when people retire from 40 years of service to a company, as they've always been very great allegiance towards the company when they're working, they went to the florist shop, and they would pack some leaves, fall leaves, and then some moss, and in it, in this sort of bouquet, they would put two or three of these matsutake pine mushrooms, and which symbolized vigorousness and life, and of course the mushrooms are able to have in them very rare minerals, and that's why shiitake mushrooms and many of them are considered to be so medicinal. And so in Japan, the matsutake, the mushroom, is it's okay, you're leaving us after 35 or 40 years of service to the company, here's to you and long life, and they'll give you these two or three mushrooms, and they will pay anything up to $200 to $300 in Japan for each mushroom.
Wow.
So that's the magic of the mushroom. And if I have a few more moments,
let me just ask you about the flavor of mushrooms. Does the flavor vary quite definitely between the different, amongst the different weather types of mushrooms?
Not only the flavor varies, but the texture varies.
Uh-huh.
And so I actually eat some of them raw. And right now up in the Seymour Valley, there's many alder or poplars. When they fall down, you have a little mushroom called an angel's wings, and you know they're like a polypore. You know they don't grow in the ground. They actually grow on the log, and so they're white and they're small, about 1.5 to 2 inches wide, and usually you get a whole cluster of them, and if you touch them, they flap like the angel wants to fly. So it's an easy one, and they're quite tasty too. But the other one that's very much prized and quite numerous in Capilano Canyon as well, and they grow at the same place, always at the same year, you can walk to the same place, a chanterelle. If people are interested in mushrooms, you buy a book, and then you find some that don't have any poisonous lookalikes. And here we have the chanterelle, which has the spores go right from the stem all the way to the top, the underneath the mushroom. It has an irregular top, and it is concave, and they're usually either white or orange, usually orange. So unmistakable, even though there is a mushroom called a false chanterelle, but I don't know how people can make that mistake.
And they look kind of dried? Dry?
Sometimes you see them in the store, they're orangey,
okay. Yeah.
And they're kind of dry looking, but when you pick them in the forest, and the other secret here is, one needs to cut the stem with a knife. Some mushrooms you can pull out and they will regenerate, but the chanterelles, if you go in the forest, you can cut them. But you know, listen.
What do you see in Chinatown?
In China, oyster
lots
mushrooms.
Lots of fungi.
You can take that because they don't like sunlight. So you can take you can buy mycelium. You can Google it, and you drill little holes into an alder log, and you can place these spores in there. Yeah. And lo and behold, if you've done that in the spring, planted the mycelium in there, put it in a place where under a tree where it won't have any sunlight. In fact, dark. The oyster mushrooms will grow. hey, grow your own. Mm. It's very exciting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you see large mushrooms in Chinatown, too. Are they reishi, the red ones, the red reishi?
The red ones.
Yeah, that's very expensive.
Yes, they're very expensive. In fact, that's called a lobster mushroom. Oh. And if you smell it, it smells like a lobster.
Oh, really?
And it's a very interesting mushroom because it is actually a host mushroom. In other words, it needs another mushroom to become what it is. And if, I know those are being sold, but if its host is toxic, so will the lobster mushroom be toxic.
And how will you know?
Experiment? Most mushrooms are toxic, but won't kill you.
2 minutes.
Well, thank you for that, okay. Carl. There's a lot to know about mushrooms. This is a little story that I found rather amusing. Maybe some people wouldn't, but a man talking about his first wife, and unfortunately, she was tragically killed by a poisonous mushroom. And then my second wife, he went on to say, happened to also die from a poisonous mushroom. The person who was talking with him said, oh, I'm so sorry to hear that. Surely it didn't happen to your third wife. And he said, no, she died of a blow on the head. She wouldn't eat her mushrooms.
Oh, dear. And anyway, we have 1 minute left here because I'd like to just refer to the old Greeks who were fond of mushrooms. And the ancient Greek mythology tells us that they believed that the mushrooms came from Zeus, lightning god, because the lightning god, and because they appear in the night, and after lightning, suddenly these mushrooms would appear. And here's wishing you a happy Halloween. Thank you for listening to Animal Voices.
Simon James, Alexander, Rags, Bill III.